Surprise, everybody. It's Langanathan. Just giving you guys a quick reminder before the show starts to check out our Kickstarter, the Jaded Gamercast Adepticon Double Date.
Yeah, I bet you were expecting intro music right now, like a sucker. But no, honestly, give it a check it out. We're looking to go to Adepticon and make lots of fucking kick-ass content for everyone. And we can only do it with your help. So check it out. We got merch. Merch, merch, merch.
Merch, 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 including glassware, shirts, and your chance to get in on the show as a guest host. But keep in mind, there's only two of those spots left, as three very eager jaded gamers are going to be joining us sometime in the near future to talk about whatever the fuck they want. If that sounds good to you, check it out. Once again, that is the Jaded Gamercast Adepticon Double Date on Kickstarter. Pour something flammable into your glass. It's JD Gamercast. My name is Lang. With me, as always, is Nathan. Nathan, I'm drinking some beers that were left at my house.
So is it like one of the like 12 blackberry cider that
No, they took those home. They took those home. No, it's the Ginja Ninja.
Oh, the stir fry beer.
Yes, the stir fry beer and swing span.
I never tried that one.
Nobody did. It was unopened.
Oh, okay, because I was going to say, the stir-fry beer is like, you're just like, it's beer and, oh my god, that is stir-fry.
Yeah, I just opened
it's
that one up.
So heavily ginger.
Interesting.
Stir-fry, right there, because you're just like, yeah, it's beer. And
I'm still tasting ginger. And I continue to taste the ginger. Fantastic. What are you drinking tonight, Nathan?
I have Hogshead Death by Pumpkin Spiced Ale.
Ah, yes.
While we were up this weekend, I had a chance to go and get my growler refilled.
Yes, you went and loaded up.
Indeed. So, I am sitting happy with that one.
Wonderful. You are listening to Jaded Gamercast. So, we got a big show ahead of us. We will be reviewing the Planetfall rulebook. That we got. We finally got a starter set and rulebook in the mail.
Yep. Well, actually, this one is from Imaginary Wars.
That's correct.
It beats Spartan Games Post to the colonies. I mean, judging by the internet, if you were based in the UK, you got yours like the day after it was supposed to ship.
Mm-hmm.
But here we are. It's just like, what, day plus like 31, and they're just like, we still don't know where it is.
Yeah, that's pretty much what it comes down to, which is really hilarious because, I mean, we know that Spartan is a small company and they have problems with these sorts of things and they don't seem to really quite understand their target demographic in a lot of cases.
When, yes.
Like, the rules come out and we still don't have the PDFs for the various armies and what their shit does, we're kind of stuck with what's in the starter kit's campaign book.
Yeah, I find that so bizarre because, I mean, I literally checked their website right before we started recording. There's still nothing for Planetfall. We still have no rules. Here I am, like Johnny Undecided, where it's just like, okay, we picked up the starter set because you and your love of Directorate is well documented.
Well documented.
Terry really liked the look of the Aquan ship, so I was like, great, we'll get a starter set. It makes sense. But I'm like, I'm still on the fence about these two other ones, these actually three, if we're going to be perfectly honest, different options. And it's just like, okay, well, how about I read through the rules, I'll look at all the fleet lists, and I'll pick the one who plays closest to how I want to play the game.
Right. This time around, you will make an informed decision as opposed to an NS aesthetics decision.
Absolutely. Or, as Spartan Games has decided, fuck you, asshole. You'll pick whatever we tell you to pick.
Go to hell, idiot. You're not going to get that shit.
Right?
Now, granted, there's not a whole lot of stuff out right now, and the starter set is still a good idea for anybody who's even remotely interested in the models that you get there. The starter kit is literally packed, like packed to the rafters, but we will talk about that a little bit more. Let's move on to the weekly listener poll. The question that we had for you guys was, as a tabletop gamer, do you also play RPG games like D&D and Pathfinder? And 67% of the vote said yes, they do also play those types of games, which was actually a lot lower than I expected.
Really, it was, yes. Was it?
Yeah, I expected it to be closer to 80% said yes. I mean, most of the tabletop gamers that I have known over the years have all at one point or another played a role-playing game like that. So kind of a surprise not to see that. We didn't have a ton of comments. Ian said yes twice because it's Ian. And then other Ian had a very long post regarding like canned campaigns and some interesting stuff. Definitely worth a read, but I'm not going to read through it at this point because we got a big thing here.
It is a novella. Honestly, to address what Elon is saying, I agree. I think that while the canned the canned scenarios are fun and amazing to get started in, and you have to keep in mind that at this point we've had two sessions for a total play time of 7 hours, which gives me 7 hours of D&D experience. I am enjoying it, even though, there were a lot of abilities that I picked that just have no place in it. But I think that a lot of that stuff is really just kind of, and you had some really great ideas, to be honest, when you get to the end of that, some really interesting ideas. I think that's really great for kind of experienced parties. We are at the point right now in our campaign where we have basically murdered every possible lead. Because, it's just like, we walk into a room, someone draws a sword, we fucking kill him. Straight up, right. we murder the shit out of them. And so it's just like, we're trying to find a castle where none of the townsfolk know where it is, and all of the bad guys that would know, we accidentally murder before we get information out of them. And it wasn't until hour six when Lang was just like, you can knock people out cold. I'm like, you mean murder isn't the only thing I know? Oh my God, there is so many doors have just opened for me.
Well, yeah, and it's one of the things where we talked about last episode where I was like, you're still in the headspace of a tabletop gamer where you're like, okay, what are the five actions I can take? And it's like, yes. No. That's not how the game works, man. You do whatever you want to do, right? It's about being clever and playing the story. But again, also the thing is, at level one, if you've never played the game before, all you want to do is just have your character be a badass, right? You don't want to be making deals and shit like that. You want to go for it, but oh, good Lord, yes. But yeah, absolutely. I think the thing here is normally I like to run custom-built campaigns. Those are the things that I actually get the most enjoyment out of. However, having never played 5th until I picked this up, and considering the fact that we decided that we wanted to play all of 4 days before we read the rules and had gone through everything, the starter kit was literally the perfect into it. A day's prep? Okay, go.
Yeah, and I mean, honestly, I feel like when I think about it, it's just obviously we will eventually come to the end of this story. Yeah. After that, I'm hoping that our levels are sufficient to take on the other campaign book that Wizards of the Coast has released with, I think it was the one about the dragon.
Mm-hmm. The dragon's horde.
Or whatever it is. And I'm just and really just kind of get our feet wet doing a couple of prepared campaigns before we run off script, because I think it gives you a great idea of, how to DM this group of kittens. And it kind of gets us more familiar with thinking in the way that role players have to. And I think that's kind of what, like I said, I personally would like to see happen. But hey, I'm just happy to be playing because I got a new level, so I suck tremendously less.
Yes, you turned into a bear and hilarity ensued.
actual still laugh at the images, hilarity.
Yeah, that moment was pretty fun. Anyways, that's thanks to everyone who voted on the weekly listener poll. You can find those at jadedgamercast.com. We will have another question for you at the end of the show, of course, if we remember. So let's move on. We're going to talk about Planetfall.
You mean Firestorm : Planetfall.
Firestorm Planetfall Ground Warfare is actually, and the Lightning Thief is actually what we're talking about here. So, very first thing that I got in the mail was the rule book, and I was absolutely pissed off that it was not hardbound. It's already falling apart on me. Mine was not bound particularly well. Like right there in the first page, it's all mucked up and I can see the glue is fucking everywhere. And then going through the book and kind of reading it and like setting it on pages, you just hear it crick and crack a little bit too much. And I mean, this thing is not going to last.
No, I don't think so. I mean, what's odd about mine is mine was from the starter set. And despite sitting at the bottom of a box with models wrapped in bubble wrap on top of it, somehow I was still able to get one with a big fucking rip in the cover and like the first 10 pages. And I was like, how?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was clearly ripped before you put it in the box, because it certainly wasn't the fucking bubble wrap that did this.
Right. And as much as I enjoy the rules as they stand so far, the book is littered with errors and screw-ups.
Okay, whoa, let me stop you there. Compared to the Dystopian Wars 2.0 rulebook, this is a work of art. And I'm like, no, I'm not even kidding you.
I know, you've shown me.
There are issues. So you're like, because like you notice the one in the image that I missed out where they're just like, well, you see, because the Core Helix is directorate, and then you look in the picture, it's like Core Helix Ralthosa. You're like, interesting.
Yeah.
You know, and I've encountered, I think, two or three sentences with two periods.
Yeah.
There was one that was a fragment that asked a question that ended on a fragment on like a period where it's just like, if we look at this period, and I'm like, what?
There's images that are also missing images where it's like, if you see two successes and then in the image there's one success and an arrow pointing to nothing, which is very interesting. But yeah, like weird grammatical things. Sentence structure is a little funny in some of these. You do have to read them a couple of times to really understand what the fuck they're talking about. But for the most part, if you've read through the book, you are able to grasp the concepts very well. There might be a couple of odd little things in there that probably require an FAQ, but I haven't played enough of the game at this point to really pick them out, considering that we only played one game with the starter set.
Yeah.
But yeah, the book, I mean, I don't understand why it's not a hardcover. I mean, I get that this is a new game and maybe you don't want to go big money right out the gates.
You know what I think it is? I don't know, like, maybe it's Dystopian Wars is hardcover kind of flopped, because I know that when Dystopian Wars 2.0 launched, they launched with a hardcover rulebook, or you could get a small soft cover in the starter set, Very Games Workshop, in the approach. And then, like, 4 months later, they're just like, yeah, okay, we're just selling the small soft cover rulebook separately, so... yeah, you can not have to deal with a hardcover if you don't want to. Because, yeah, I mean, it could be it's a new game. It could be that the Dystopian Wars hardcover just fucking flopped. Like, I don't know. Obviously, we don't have eyes on the business decisions that they're making and their sales figures. But I do agree. I do find it a little disappointing to not have a hardcover core set of rules, because... yeah, I mean, like, if we look at Spartan's typical lifespan of editions, it's kind of in that 3 to 4 years, right? There is no possible way that this small book will last me 3 to 4 years, even if all I do is play, like, 2 games a month. Like, there is no way that just flipping through it that nominally would... it would last. It just can't happen.
All right, so let's talk about the rest of the starter set. As we said before, it is packed full and, like, to the brim. That box is barely big enough to fit everything that they've crammed into it. The models themselves are way larger than you would think. We were both just blown away at the size of the models. We thought that they would be much smaller, more similar to Flames of War, in the sense of just like, you know, here's this tank, here's what this tank does, you know, a little matchbox car sized stuff. But no, the heavy tank is fucking huge. It's battleship sized. Like, well, yeah. It is big.
It absolutely is. Because, I mean, like, basically, the infantry is Flames of War size. I think if I were to put the Aquin infantry that I have next to some Flames of War, they're going to be about the same size. And knowing that, I was expecting, like, the scale to work like that. But what ends up happening is you have the light recon tanks, which are about the size of all tanks, the large tanks of Flames of War, and are about the size of frigates. Really, like most tier 3. Yeah. I mean, sometimes you might get longer or shorter or fatter or whatever, but they are on par with the size of Tier 3, because I know my Aquin light recons were bigger than, like, your directed hostility drones.
Yeah, my bling buggies were bigger than my drones, which was pretty awesome.
Yeah, so, I mean, like, you have that, and then it just ratchets up, where it's, like, the mediums are cruiser size, my Aquin heavy and your directorate heavy were about the size of your battleship. Not as fat, and obviously less three-dimensional.
Bigger than my space station, for sure.
Oh, yeah, that's what I meant. Your space station wasn't the battleship. It wasn't on the table. But, yeah, and it's just, like, that to me is really interesting, because we have pictures in here of, like, Leviathans dwarfing that stuff. So it's just like, these Leviathans in Planetfall will be larger than Dreadnoughts and Firestorm.
Yeah.
Make no mistake.
And Dreadnoughts and 40K.
Yeah, much bigger than a 40K.
Right, exactly. I mean, really, if we go, we talk about the models themselves. You guys have heard us talk about how much we love the models in the starter set, the way they look. They look just as good, if not better, once you get them on the table. They're really slick. They're very well molded. Out of the entire box set, none of our models were mismolded. Really sturdy resin as usual. I actually dropped one of my tanks down the stairs.
Oh shit, really?
Yeah, after I went upstairs to do a little bit of cleaning before we played, and then as I was walking down, I dropped, and like the turret goes and the tank goes 20 stairs down, no carpet. Wooden stairs, because I'm ghetto like that. I haven't carpeted our stairs yet. But again, like, this is to illustrate the point, nothing broke. Like, really sturdy stuff, really strong stuff.
That's awesome.
You know, if it had been Games Workshop, it would have mashed like Play-Doh and then shattered like a grenade. So basically, you know.
Yeah, uh-huh.
100%. That's science. I don't know what you guys know, but I know these things. And yeah, like, really, really impressive stuff. But the models look great. On the table, they look fantastic, which is a bit of a kick in the pants when they give you this half-assed modular building scenery in the starter set.
Oh, my God, right?
Now, I get that they're not going to give you the nice scenery that they have for sale, because the nice, like, resin scenery that they're going to be selling. I totally get it. Like, that stuff's the premium. That's the stuff that you want to go for, but...
These are the Catachan trees, sir.
Oh, no, these are worse. Like, these are worse than Mordheim scenery. And Mordheim scenery was pretty decent, all things considered. But this is basically, like, they give you a bunch of cardboard punch-outs, right, for the shapes of what you want to do. And then in order to hold these punch-outs together, they don't just have, like, a plastic piece of gray plastic. They use that ghetto weird-ass clear plastic.
That everyone hates working with, yep.
Everyone despises. If you've ever done a battle station with it, it's god-awful. It constantly cracks and breaks. It's almost impossible to clean and make it actually look proper, and it has no texturing whatsoever on it. So it's just like, you know, it's these very weird flat buildings. And even in the pictures of these modular buildings, they don't show it as clear plastic. Like, somebody's gone and Photoshopped the plastic black so that you don't notice it.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, it looks awful. So, like, you would have to go prime it, break it off, prime it again, so that you can cover up all those little bits and pieces that are sticking off. And then you've got these little pieces of modular scenery that's all well and good. But for the most part, it's kind of a throwaway. I don't, you know, you're much better off buying the resin scenery from what we've seen of it so far. Because this is just, I mean, very, very much bottom of the barrel. We ended up using Tupperware for scenery because we just
didn't want to go
build it. Yeah,
did not want to go through and try to build it.
Which totally looked like we were on the grid, though. It was Tron.
Yes.
It was all Tron all day on the grid with all this Tupperware as our buildings. It was pretty funny.
Yes, it was.
but yeah, you know, outside of that, you get tack cards, which are on flimsy-ass paper. Not even as good as the hard board paper that you get. The card paper that you get in
the Firestorm
box. Or what you also got in Dystopian, I believe.
Yeah.
It is like flimsy ass paper that looks like it had a really hard time going through the paper cutter because, like, the edges are all gnarled up. And again, it's just very low quality for something that you're going to be using over and over and over again over so many different games. Like, you would much rather see that card stock. Like, why? I don't understand why you wouldn't just use the same card stock you used for your other games.
Yeah, and maybe it is what you said. It's a new game. Spartan wants to support
costs.
It, but that's exactly it. Is they are cutting costs because they're not sure if it's going to be a hit. And, you know, you're not going to go into the red launching a new game. So, I mean, I don't know. Yes, they can improve on things like that, and I'd like to see it happen, especially if the game is as popular in real life as it appears to be online. I mean, there's a lot of people talking about it, in, you know, on Facebook, in, locally, and in, like, the sort of global Firestorm Armada group.
And we know that that starter kit and rule book sold way more than they expected.
Which is why they had to push it
away, right?
Yeah, they pushed it a week to try to produce more. So we know it's exceeding expectations. Hopefully that will translate to higher quality items. Because I, for one, would love to get a hardcover core rule book that is in the same vein as the one that I have for Firestorm Armada.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Outside of that, you also get your tokens and your counters. The 0 hour tracking token that you get is a piece of shit.
Oh my god, yes.
It's, again, not even as well designed as the battle log. I thought it would be more like the battle log, right? Where it kind of slides over and it's a single piece. But instead, what they give you is this little template looking thing that is, again, on fairly thin stock. And then there's just these little notched pieces of that thin stock that you just kind of like wedge onto the template.
And in no way, no matter, because like there's two ways that you can get it on the template, because like it's the threefold, right? So you can decide which way to do it. There is no way that doesn't have them like just jutting up. And I mean, like, because like when I saw it, like, you know, it's very reminiscent of a game like Zombicide with their experience trackers. And that's all you need. Like, honestly, I think I'm probably going to, if I choose to use that one, steal the plastic nubs out of my Zombicide set and use them, because they'll sit flush on that and allow me to slide them as needed, as opposed to this approach where we both just realized that using our D100, you know,
D100 and D10
was better and easier.
Well,
and
it's like
it looked less ghetto using a pair of D10s than it did using the one that was included and designed as part of the skin.
Yes, exactly. Not only do they jut out and they're very awkward, but again, because this isn't particularly hard stock paper, they kind of just fall off. They slide around on their own. I noticed at one point that like I'd put it down, I'd come back and it had like shifted off to the side onto another number. It really is just low quality, unfortunately. And the funniest thing out of the whole thing is like all of this stuff is like perforated so that you can punch it out of the card. But the only thing that's not perforated so that you can punch them out of the card is the tokens.
Yes.
And yeah.
And like the blast template and things like that. I was like,
you have to like go get your scissors and cut a perfect circle out of this thing for the blast template. Like it. really weird.
Okay, so with all of those sort of minor complaints, you know, because keep in mind, I mean, it's fun to take the piss out of them for quality and for kind of these weird decisions. I personally think the game is great. You?
Yeah, I'm very, very intrigued by it. I enjoy the way that the rules are laid out. There's a couple of weird, interesting things that while reading the rules, I was kind of unsure about, but actually seeing them in play on the table, I found it actually really interesting. Mm-hmm. It creates an interesting flow to the game where you are very focused on objectives, but if you're not also killing things, you're going to be having a very, very hard time holding the table and making it work for you. I really liked the way that they handled movement and the arcs and all that kind of stuff was really straightforward, really simple. Line of sight was, again, really straightforward, really simple. Everything was very, very streamlined. So even on a game this size, we played basically on a 4x4, it was about 1,250 points. The game had a great flow to it. It was really simple to pick up. Very, very few times did we ever have to jump back to the rule book. Typically when we did, it was for like rules clarifications on Mars.
Yeah, and that I was going to say, I think all I ever looked at was Mars. And before we played our game, I had not even finished reading the rules. I'd only read about 90% of them. But, you know, as you said, you're just like, oh, don't worry about it. That part's easy. We'll just go.
Right.
So it's just like I had not even read through the entire rule book once. Obviously, we just played a pitched battle, you know, deploy, go, have fun. But, yeah, like I said, it was just the fact that the game was that simple and that streamlined, I think is great, because honestly, one of my biggest complaints with Firestorm Armada as a starting player is, holy fuck, the game is complicated. And there's so much you have to remember to do. Yep. Where it's just like, when do you link versus when do you combine? Can I use point defense against that? I've taken 1 point of hull damage, but three crew are dead.
You've got your command phase and then your primary movement, and then your secondary movement. And then in the secondary movement, if you're launching wings, then the order changes depending on whether they're making an attack run or they previously launched that turn.
Absolutely. So it's just like Firestorm is a very finicky game with a lot of rules. Planetfall is almost like the exact opposite, where it's just like you can tell that there was the influence of their previous work, like Stone Wars, like Firestorm. It pulls the aspects of the games that work well, and it streamlines everything else. And it streamlines it in such an elegant way that you don't even feel like you're losing out, because I feel like the game mechanics themselves are so simple and easy to remember that you end up focusing on what you're doing and how to move your shit more. Mm-hmm. And that's great. Like, that's exactly what you want in a miniature game. So why don't we move on to talking about the rules?
Sure.
Or do we want to talk about our game? Or what do we want
to do? Let's talk about our game first. And then we'll talk about the rules. We'll kind of break out how movement functions, cool. Movement, shooting, things like that. So I was playing Directorate. Nathan was playing Aquins, obviously. We played the standard scenario, as I said before, 1,250 points. This is essentially what you would consider to be like an evenly matched game right out.
Although one thing that I do want to point out, which I thought was bizarre, was that the Aquin force comes out to 1,380 points, but the Directorate is only 1,215.
Yeah, and like I said, I'm almost positive that comes down to the fact that instead of just giving you more Aquin objective markers, what they did is they gave you the crystals and they gave you the anti-air turrets and essentially said, right, make the choice. You can buy one or the other, and then the other two models are your objectives, right? Pick one.
Because your Directorate had two objective tokens.
That's right.
The Aquins had zero. But no, I said, I just thought it was kind of weird that, you know, one force does have more points. Now, even then, what's so hilarious is that I could have purchased and played like 165 points more than you, but since the starter set has no flyers, they wouldn't have been able to do dick.
Yeah, they literally would have done nothing. So
you're just like, yeah, okay, I guess.
It was kind of a weird thing, but after we pulled everything out and put everything together, it was like, oh no, it is actually pretty much right where it needs to be. Mm-hmm. The game we played in about 45 minutes.
I think it took I thought it was closer to a half an hour. I think maybe 45 minutes on the clock, but that's because midway through Scotty and Andrew showed up and we were kind of chit-chatting with them while we were playing. The gameplay itself is fast. I love the way the victory conditions work. Cause it's basically an improved battle log. Really, that's what it is. It's taking that battle log system that I love and improving on it. But our game was very straightforward. We weren't playing with any of the scenarios of the starter set. Straight pitched battle, you know, go. A lot of Tupperware scenery, and I feel like the game needs it. Like based on the small game that we played, I feel like scenery that shuts down, lots of scenery, lots of buildings that shut down line of sight, create elevation so you can have better line of sight. That's the way to play this game.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
You absolutely need it. And then as we start getting more models in the game, like flyers and elevated units, it definitely is going to bring out a lot of different tactics to the game, which will be really interesting. Because of the fact that it's not like 40K in line of sight, right? Where everything is according to this scale and it's like true line of sight, everybody. Like there's really none of that. What they've done is they've almost gone back to older versions of 40K.
Yeah, it's 4th ed 40K line of sight.
They basically say like, this is a light unit. You know, light units don't block line of sight for armored units, and then armored units block armored units, and the elevated units can shoot over armored units, and so on and so forth. Flyers can shoot over everything, yada yada yada. but that works very well within the scope of the game because, again, the goal of this is very clearly to make a fast game. Now, the bigger the game gets, it is going to play like 40K in the sense that you're probably going to be putting in 2.5 to 3 hours for like a really, you know, like a real big game. But I think tournament sized force, if you're talking like 3,000 or 4,000 points, will still go run, I would say, 90 minutes for like experienced players, because the way that the game is structured, essentially it's not like 40K. It's not like Firestorm in the sense where like you activate, you declare targets, you calculate up all your arcs, you do all the things, then you shoot direct and indirect. The majority of these things have one weapon, one arc. So you move, you
shoot. Yeah, I was going to say, Leviathans, I expect, will kind of slow it down because they do talk about in the rules about how you can shoot any guns at any target. So I think Leviathan specifically was like, this arm has this Gatling cannon, this arm has this Uber cannon.
Yeah.
So this one's going to shoot this way, this one's going to shoot that way.
But even still, the stats we've seen for the Leviathan, we are talking like two weapons, right? In 2 to 3, maybe. So yeah, Leviathans will take a little bit longer, but in general, I don't think it's going to be like a mass, like anything near what you would see for Firestorm, where, you know, you're shooting out of four arcs and then torpedoes and then a boarding.
Oh, absolutely. So I mean, to give the listeners an idea, basically the way that victory works in Planetfall is you have what is called your 0 hour tracker. That's that flimsy piece of shit we were talking about. The way it works is it starts at a value, which is typically the points value that you are playing divided by 10, so 3,000 point game, or divided by 100, or whatever. Drop two zeros. If you're playing 3,000 points, it's a 30 point, you know, your 0 hour starts at 30. If you're playing 6,000 points, it starts at 60. And the way it works is as you score points, your tracker counts down to zero. And what I love about that, because like when I first read it, I was like, well, that's interesting. And then the next section, like the very next sentence, they're like, which means you can make the, you know, your 0 hour tracker longer for longer games or shorter for shorter games. And I was like, this game is perfect for tournaments.
Right.
And the example that I've been using is that if you were to, say, play a 4,500 point army, then we know that your 0 hour would normally start at 45. But we can say for tournaments, we're going to play this points value, so 4,500, but your 0 hour starts at 30, which means that you're going to see games finish ahead of time, like before the actual clock forces games to be called for time, which I love. And the other thing is they've basically just broken it down to there's a major victory, a minor victory, and a draw. A major victory is my 0 hour hit zero and yours hasn't. Major victory for me. A minor victory is both of ours hit zero at the same time, but I destroyed more tactical value.
In that turn.
So it's a minor win for me. And then a draw is we hit zero at the same time and our tactical value on that turn is the same. It's a draw. So you're just like, it plays fast, and the fact that you can scale basically the timer of your game, it's almost like War Machine with the death clock, you know, where it's just like, it doesn't matter how many points of War Machine you play, you got your 60 minute death clock. You know, if you time yourself out, you lose. The way 0 hour works and how you can modify it and slide it to a smaller number for your points value means that tournament games should never be called before they're finished, which is literally the opposite of Firestorm Armada, because I think in four tournaments that I've played, I have never, ever finished a game ahead of time. It's just never happened. I play Aquins, which have so many minor activations, or Terrans, which are designed to just never really kill anything but not die either. So.
Yeah. So let's talk about movement. All movement values for units in the game are separated into two separate values by a slash that sometimes has a space and doesn't have a space because of editing. Basically, what you have there is a cruising speed and a flat out speed. If you do your cruising speed, you can move up to that speed. You have as many pivots along the way that you can take. So if you want to move 3 inches, pivot, move 3 inches, pivot, move 3 inches. So think about it very much that, you know, even though they try to kind of give the impression that this is a vehicle turning, as long as you can bend your tape measure around a corner, your vehicles can do that. So it's very similar to 40K in that sense, where if you know you're just moving the Marine, he can just move wherever as long as you have the inches to do that. Because no matter where you end up, you can still pivot at the last turn and have the facing that you generally want.
Yes.
If you move flat out, you have to move between the max of the cruising speed to the max of the flat out speed. So you can't go like, I'm moving flat out and move forward 1 inch. You have to move up to that speed. You can take one pivot before you start, and then you have to go straight at that
point. Yep.
So there's no pivots outside of the first one, but you can go blazing up the table, which is fantastic. Outside of that, if you move flat out, you cannot
shoot.
You cannot shoot. So it's purely there for movement. It's purely there for people who are trying to like grab objectives. But like if objectives are in a hard to reach place, you know, around a couple of corners, you're not going to get to those objectives on the first turn. It's one of those things where, you know, a smart person placing objectives is going to place it in such a way that somebody's not going to be able to get to that objective lickety split, you know, in one zoom up the table at 15 inches with their recon squad, right? Which is a very kind of interesting aspect of the game, considering the fact that everything has a flat out speed. Nothing's really ever going to feel like it's so goddamn slow it's never going to get into the fight. Even if your first turn is just blazing it right up to the middle of the table and not shooting, in a lot of cases, that is a totally viable option there. The other thing to mention about movement, did you have anything to say about cruising and flat out there, Nathan?
No, it's fine. I'm just fighting a cold.
So. Yeah, I figured as much.
I try to mute my mic when I'm going to have a cough or something like that, but I missed it that time.
It's no big deal. So basically, the other thing to notice about movement is that movement is dependent on terrain, but it depends on the type of vehicle you have, whether it's wheeled or tracked, or it's a hover vehicle, or it's flying, or it's a walker. Things of that nature will have different... they'll be affected differently by various types of terrain. But all in all, there's not a whole lot to point out there. It's exactly kind of what you would think of. You know, difficult terrain slows you down. You know, these type of things, if they go into here, certain units cannot traverse certain types of terrain that other units can traverse because of their size or their type or whatever it is. Short of just reading that section of the book to you guys, terrain is handled in a very, very simple way here. Any type of terrain will have a certain designation to it, where they're just like buildings, elevated. And like, there you go. You just treat all buildings as elevated. Hills, variable. It could be elevated, could not be. Fuck, whatever. Like it, and when they kind of go breaking them down, they tell you exactly what these types of pieces of terrain are and how they affect the game. And it's like, you got to remember two or three things.
Yes. Well, and that's the thing is, like, with movement, it's straight up because it's just like cruising speed, you can shoot, flat out you can't. But then what I like about it is they add a third option, not counting embarking or disembarking onto transports, because that's common for a science fiction type game. But you have the option to remain stationary and declare one of two firing orders, and both of them are very, very, very good. One of them is Overwatch. You know it. You love it from 40K. It works in much the same way. Actually, it works like second edition 40K Overwatch, because basically if you remain stationary and you do not fire, you can choose to go on Overwatch, and then the first time anything passes within your line of sight and arc of fire, you will get an out-of-sequence shot at it. Mm-hmm. Now, you do have to keep in mind that when you read Overwatch, it doesn't say that they have to be in range. So don't declare Overwatch in the first couple turns. Like, get them into that sweet spot where you know that something's going to pass through in your sweet range and do it. But what I like about the Overwatch rule is they just straight up say, Overwatch is rushed, you hit on 5+ instead of 4s. So it's just like, yeah, you have that advantage to set up a good defensible position that you know they have to pass through, or you're hoping they don't, and your Overwatch is your deterrence.
You don't have to take the shot for Overwatch, by the way.
Really?
Yeah, it says you can immediately perform an out-of-sequence. So if they are out of range or they're not in the effective range that you're looking for, you can just let them buzz by. So it still does work.
Can immediately. Oh, okay. No, that's fine. So,
The other option is focused fire. So how does that one work, Nathan?
Focused fire
is that kind of leads into the next part of like how shooting functions.
Oh my god, is this a segue?
It is.
Focused fire is basically you saying I'm not going to move because I'm aiming, and then you succeed on 3+ for your subsequent shooting phase.
Yes.
And that's what's so great about the game is it's streamlined. 4+ always, unless you have a Mar, a TAC card, or you focus fire, then it's a 3+. And then, you know, or if you're rushed or there's a Mar or a TAC card or an effect, like Cyber Warfare, I think, can force me to be rushed, can't it?
Yes, it can.
Yeah, so it's just like there are ways where it's just like, yeah, you know, we can force this, but then it's a 5+. But it's just so straightforward in that, where it's just like, it's like Firestorm. 4s always succeed.
That's right. So essentially, when it comes to firing in terms of movement, these are the only real times that you're going to see firing affecting movement for the most part. When we say rushed and placed would be what's used for focused fire. Placed is considered to be a 3+, rush is considered to be a 5+. So even if you use Overwatch, you'll only hit on 5s.
Yep.
Right. So it's all great. It's all well and good. It's nice to have because you might get a chance to, you know, pop shots at the side of a tank where its armor is slightly weaker, or even in the rear, depending on how awesome that turns out to be. But even in that case, it's still not as good as moving into the proper firing position and actually taking a proper shot. So yay options, but it's also not going to put games on the table where people say everything's on Overwatch Go.
Yeah,
everything's on Overwatch Go.
And that's what's brilliant about it is I know that second edition 40K really ended up being that Overwatch game of chicken where it's just like, this is my Uber shooting unit. They're on Overwatch. And it's just like, yeah, if your combat unit comes near him, I'm going to fucking kill him. But, yeah, you're absolutely right. You are almost always better off moving into the position that you need and firing. Like for me, I look at Overwatch as all of my movement options are a shit sandwich where it's just like,
yeah,
listen, I move over here. I'm getting fucked up in the subsequent activations. I move over here, blah, blah, blah.
If you're holding an objective and you don't want to move and you don't have a shot. That's what Overwatch comes into play, where it's just like, well, this is the alternative. At least they're not wasted.
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, like, there are a couple of options there, and that's what's so good about it. But again, placed fires, that is the exact opposite, where it's just like, I'm already in the position I want to be. I want to light this thing up. So, you know what? I'm just going to remain stationary. I'm going to place fire, and I'm going to fuck it up.
So, if you're currently thinking to yourself, wait, what the fuck? How is there a Spartan Games game that doesn't involve a turning template? Hey, guess what? Turning template's still there. But you're only ever going to use it for lumbering vehicles. So vehicles with the lumbering Mar.
We're assuming that it'll be Leviathans.
Yeah, Leviathans, and there may be some tanks that count as lumbering and stuff like that. But basically, the only thing that's ever going to use the turning template is something that's lumbering, and there is nothing in the starter set that is lumbering. Even these big ass heavy tanks still can pivot as many fucking times as they want.
Well, yeah, and the Aquan heavy tank is fast as fuck and can
pivot. All the Aquan shit is fast as fuck.
Oh, I noticed that while we were playing, and I was just like, holy shit, because I was just like, I'll take my flat out move on my recon. That's 17 inches, and you're like, mine's 14. I was like, what?
Right. Yeah, like, I'm sure that I have maybe slightly higher than normal speed because of dune buggies, but basically, like, I know the Terrans are going to be slow. I know that the Dindrenzi are also going to be slow.
No, like, Dindrenzi are going to be fast, because if you read about how they talk about Dindrenzi playing, they're like, Dindrenzi use their speed to jump in and smash in close range and then withdraw. I think that Cerulean's, the artillery masters, are going to be slow as fuck.
Along big ass Wakas.
Yeah, like I think my Terran heavy tank will lumber. But even then, maybe not.
Well, you never know because you know, they haven't released the rules yet.
Right.
Like pricks. Okay, so
tell me how you really feel.
I always do. So basically, that's what you want to know about movement. I don't want to get into sky drops because it's a little bit there's a fair amount of detail there. It's not confusing.
No, it's not hard, but like the way sky drops and artillery works, where it's just like you have to deploy these markers, and then only these models can help pinpoint it. And da, 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 da. It just it's a subset of rules that are very easy that require specific models in your force to have certain mars to even make use of them.
That's right. Think about it like this. Like in 40K, you have a deep strike rule where only certain models can deep strike. And then in 40K, you also have only certain models that can take a teleport homer. It's kind of similar to that, except you have to shoot at the teleport homer after you deploy the targets that the deep strike. Like it almost feels backwards to what you're used to, but it's actually a really straightforward
process. And it works really well.
It does work pretty well.
The aqua, because you said, you have nothing with artillery that can shoot off those markers, and you had no sky drops, whereas the Aquans did. But even like for me, I was just like, oh, this is really straightforward.
Yeah.
At no point was I just like, this is bullshit, and it's hard, and it's fucked up, even though both of my crystals accidentally ended up being like beside each other.
That's right. It still worked for you. You got that side shot.
Right?
Bing, bong, bong. Just pinballing it around corners. That was actually hilarious. But basically, let's move us on here. So leadership in this game accounts to disorder markers. And you're never going to really run into a situation where your stuff is falling back. It's just not going to happen in the game. Instead, disorder markers at the end of the phase, disorder markers provided to you either by game mechanics or failed disorder checks, at the end of the phase, translate into damage, right? So if you fail if you fail really hard, that squad can just be wiped out, right? And it adds some very weird mechanics to the game that, as you're reading it, just you're sitting there going like, this all just seems really bad. Like nothing about this is good. But kind of as you get into the game, you understand why they do it, because generally, the shit in this futuristic warscape is very tough.
Yes. And it
is very durable. More so than the amount of firepower that they put out. Right? Well, and yeah, exactly. Like Firestorm. Where in Firestorm, it's just like, I got my squad of three cruisers. And then they're all dead. Whereas in this one, like, it's a lot harder to really chew down your opponent because you just don't have the firepower to just blow through tanks. It just, yep. It's not out there. Even the big heavy tank is not blowing through tanks.
I had one amazing roll, which only did what I needed it to do because you failed both of your shields.
Yes.
And I moved into your flank. Otherwise, it would have been 1 point of damage.
That's right. And basically, it was like, and that was against one tank.
So, oh, yeah, that was shooting at one single tank. I had been, like, I tried not to shoot at your medium squad when you're like, oh, there's 7-7 with shields. And I was like, no.
So basically, the way that it works is it's similar to Firestorm Armada's disorder check in the sense that you roll three dice, and it has the exploding dice mechanic, however. Mm-hmm. So even on a command check, you can continue to roll dice past the initial three.
Yeah.
The number of successes that you need to hit, though, is not defaulted to two or three if your admiral's dead in Firestorm. It is calculated according to a couple of different factors. So the first one is a squadron will need to get an additional success depending on their quality, right? If they're elite or they're militia or if they're just regular, right? Yep. If they're regular, it's no effect, but if they're elite, they get an extra die. If they're militia, they get -1 die. And then various targeted weapons like terror weapons also affect the number of die that you get to roll. And then the number of successes depends on the amount of damage that you took. So let's say I fire at Nathan's squad with my squad, right? So my three tanks shoot at his three tanks. I do 3 points of damage amazingly. Nathan,
that was certainly not the dice we rolled.
No, absolutely not. It was hilarious. So what would happen then is immediately after we do damage, you have to roll a disorder check. So you have got the three base dice. If this guy was elite, the squad, he would get 4 dice. If he's within range of his command element, he would actually get 5 dice. And then on those 5 dice, he would have to get 3 successes, right? So for every point that he misses by, he will take a disorder marker. And then, as I said earlier, those disorder markers directly translate into damage in the end phase.
Yes.
So,
but then there's something that's hilarious. And
oh, yes.
I love it. The, like, one of the greatest parts, because, like, there are some parts of this rule book where it's just like there are just certain things that I was like, oh, this is the greatest game in the world. And this is one of them because I'm just like, I love it. So talk about Forlorn Hope.
So let's say that in that scenario where I had fired at Nathan's squad, I had done 3 points of damage. His tanks can take 2 points of damage apiece. So one tank dies, one tank has a point of damage, and the other tank has its standard 2 points of damage. So he rolls those five dice, completely whiffs it, and he takes 3 disorder markers. So since he only has 3 points of damage left, we know that in the end phase, those 3 disorder markers translate to damage, and that squad's fucking dead. They're dead. They're wiped off the table. This is when the squad is considered to be a Forlorn Hope squad. Forlorn Hope squad. Which basically means that this squad knows the end is near, right? Yep. They know there's no getting out of this, and some idiot goes, charge! And basically, these guys just go balls to the wall with a couple of really cool rules affecting them before they are wiped out. So basically, here's the things to know about Forlorn Hope. All firing using main ordnance or close quarters battle from a Forlorn Hope squadron is considered to be placed shots, no matter what you do, which is awesome. In addition, the squad may ignore all damage on their squadron when determining attack dice successes for both of their attack types, so close quarters or main ordnance.
Yep.
The Forlorn Hope squad that are ready to activate may move flat out and still fire main ordnance and execute close quarters battles, close quarter battle.
Without penalty.
Without penalty.
So you're still hitting on threes.
You're still hitting on threes. You're still placed. and they are not permitted to withdraw in the same way as other squadrons. Withdrawal works in such a way where if you move a squadron to the edge of the table, you can essentially run them off the table.
It's like shunting. You can voluntarily remove squadrons if they can get to a board edge, and you only give up half points.
That's right.
So it's great. I just think Forlorn Hope is fantastic because, like, it's that issue of you look at it and it's just like, oh, yeah, they will be removed in the end phase. But at least this way you have a chance of just really fucking something up before you go. And right. I think it's hilarious more than anything.
Yeah, even if you flop your check, you still kind of come away with something that you can use, which is pretty interesting. And that's basically all you need to know about Disorder. Like, there's really no more information in there, and even the Mars at the back of the book, there's really nothing that affects Disorder all that much. Certain units are fearless, but typically it's stuff like, you know, the crystal that Nathan drops from the sky for his Aquans is fearless, where it's just like, it'll just never take a morale check.
It's a fucking crystal that bends beams around buildings. That's all it is. It's not like it's people, they can't get scared, things like that. So the other rule for me, I've told this to everyone, Lang knows it's coming for the podcast.
Yes.
That, like, the moment I read it, I was just like, I love this game. I have yet to play a game. I don't know anything about it, but I fucking love this game. And it just talks about how with, you know, it's just like, oh, with flying models, it's just like they, you know, no one can use a close quarter attack against them. They're flying. You know, they're considered to be viable targets for surface fire. And then it's just like, can even be the target of melee attacks from towering Leviathan-sized models. And I was just like, oh my god, Leviathans can punch planes out of the air. And that was when I was like, this is the coolest game that has ever been created. Ever.
He just because, can't get over it. He's like,
I have told this to everyone because I am so excited about, like, my Terran Leviathan punching like a Works Raptor Tron ship out of the air. Like, I'm just like, that. I don't care if I win the game or not. Like, if running up in order to punch your Tron ship loses me the game and you destroy my Leviathan because I give you my rear armor, I just don't care.
That's right.
I punched a plane out of the air, and that's good enough.
Happy. So, yeah, basically, the other part of firing your main weapon is close quarters battles. Close quarters battle is very similar to point defense in Firestorm Armada or like AK-AK in Dystopian.
It's absolutely the same as AK-AK.
Basically, the way that this thing functions is that your ships have a 4-inch bubble around them with a whole bunch of like anti-infantry light weaponry that if something comes within that range, those little turrets turn and just, you know, ricochet and rocket shots all over, you know, anybody who's nearby. When you engage you know, when you attack somebody with a close quarters battle attack and they're within range of you, they basically trade shots right back at you. So it's a lot of fun. You can move up, use your close quarters battle shots immediately against a squad, and then shoot them with your main weapon as well. Or you can have the close quarters battle shoot something else and then shoot the squad with your main weapon. It's a cool aspect of the game that kind of informs you to the fact that, you know, certain forces, certain races are going to be much better with their CQB in such a way where it's like they have to get up close because their firepower outside of that is going to be way too light, that they have to get up close and really make use of that. Infantry, as far as we've seen so far, is only using that as their only form of attack. So, you know, there's some very interesting things there. There's a lot of fun stuff that, again, it opens some interesting doors in terms of like how units will be used going forward. For the Leviathans, the CQB for them will be specific to like a certain weapon, where it'll basically say like, here's the rating for it at 4 inches, where it like adds to the CQB rating of the Leviathan. And then in base to base contact, it's like way fucking bigger. And then they can just like axe a tank in half. Power Maul. And then there is a very, very simple like assault style rule called Storming CQB, where you basically do charge into close combat, but that is only used for charging buildings.
Yeah, infantry versus infantry.
That's right. Infantry versus infantry when you're occupied. And again, it's a super, super simple process. So a lot of fun there. And then, yeah.
After unless that, you flip your dice, because then I believe in the history of the Aquan Empire, they won a hand-to-hand fight.
Yes, they won a hand-to-hand fight against Directorate, which was...
And again, like, you're just like, wait, what? Because, yeah, like, you're just like, oh, as defenders, I get to go first, and, you know, I happen to kill one of yours, which is so improbable. Then you whiffed your dice rolls, and I was like, wait, what just happened? And then you had to make a flat-out move running away, and I was just like, what the hell just happened? Did my fish kill someone? What the hell?
So after that is main ordnance, and main ordnance is, I mean, there's almost nothing to say. Every weapon has a effective range and a long range.
Yeah.
You will basically, if you're firing up to your effective range, you get the dice that it has listed, which is typically higher. Yep. And if you are firing up to your long range, you get a lower value, or vice versa, depending on the type of stat that it's providing to you. And it tells you what arc you are able to fire that weapon from, either forward, left, right, or aft, or all around.
Which is AR. And I was like,
AR. It's really weird.
And right?
Huh? Aft, right? Is that what that is? Yeah, it was kind of dumb.
Yeah, it was kind of dumb.
Why they would just call it turret is beyond me.
But what I do like about this game, everything combines always. So it's not like Firestorm or Dystopian where you're trying to come up with your pool where you're like, well, this gun's going to be the lead, and then I'm going to add all these in, and then I'm going to cut in half and round up if it's Dystopian Wars and round down if it's Firestorm, because who cares about consistency? That's how the games are different, Lang.
Did you notice that this one always rounds up?
I did. And it's just like, yep. You just combine all of your dice for anyone that has line of sight and range.
And if the Mars on the weapons are the same.
And if the Mars on the weapons are the same. There is nothing in the starter set that would be different like that.
Yep.
But I'm assuming that little caveat's probably going to be for things like Leviathans.
They're
just like, my right arm has this gun.
Well, no. The Directorate Heavy Tank. The Plasma Surge had one extra Mar from the turret, so I couldn't combine them.
Oh, that's interesting. See, I thought you had just made that choice to do so, and then after that I was using my Aquan speed to stay away from that fucking tank.
No.
Like, I was just like, run! Run, bitch, run!
Yes, so another interesting thing to note about firing in the game, if you've been playing Dystopian Wars or Firestorm Armada, you know that when you take damage, your weapon values are reduced. In this game, your weapon values are never reduced because of damage. The only time your weapon values are reduced is if you are firing at something that has so many modifiers like cover or hard target that you would need 7 or more.
Yep.
At which point you have the number of dice that you're rolling, and then you just need 6s. That's basically how they handle it. So basically what happens here is that if you're firing from a squad with a damage marker on it, right? So let's say I've got 3 tanks and one of them has been damaged twice, right? So this tank has 3 hit points. It's taken 2 damage. I don't modify my dice at all. I roll the same number of dice as always, but what I will do is I will remove 2, so mm-hmm. the number equal to my damage, from my number of successes. So let's say I roll my 16 dice, I get 10 hits, I remove 2, I scored 8 hits.
Yeah, and again, it's so much easier to work out, because I mean, like, as a Terran Firestorm player, I have weapon shielding, and believe me when I say that that leads to a lot of confusion, especially with your opponent, who's obviously trying to subtract it. So you're just like, okay, well, my turret's normally 15 dice, but I've taken 3 damage, so that's going to be minus 2 because of weapon shielding, so now it's going to be 11 dice, and it's going to combine with, and it's just, it's a fucking headache. This is just straightforward, because first of all, every model has way less hit points before it's destroyed. Like, I think the most I had was my heavy tank had 3.
Yeah,
that's right. If you hit its DR 3 times, it was gone. My mediums had 2. My lights had 1. And then I fucked up and let you have a rear shot on them, and that almost wiped them all out. It was bananas. Hilarious.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, it's so much straight, you know, it's so much more straightforward to say things like, hey, you know, because this one's taking 1 damage, it means I'm going to be minus 1, so I'm just going to roll all of my dice, so I'm not having to have, like, a fucking degree in math. And then afterwards, we'll just take that one off, and we're square. Like, it's...
Yeah, it's the same thing with shields. Roll your shield dice, remove those from the hit pool as well. Like, that's basically how...
Yeah, and basically, again, you combine shields. So if he gets enough hits to hit two vehicles with shields, I grab the shields for both of them, I roll, and we just start subtracting from the back moving forward.
Right. So what he means by that, because that is another interesting aspect to the way that damage is dealt in this game.
Mm-hmm.
So if I rolled 8 hits in the previous example against 2 tanks where I'm shooting at the flank and they're basically lined up. So there's 1 tank I can see and 1 tank behind in the same squad that I essentially can't see. The way that it works is you assign a priority to who is taking damage first. So if I've got 8 hits and his DR is 3 and 3 on 1 tank, so it's got essentially 2 hit points, and then the next tank is also 3 and 3, mm-hmm. what will happen is I'll assign 6 damage to the first tank, essentially destroying it, and then 2 damage will go to the next tank, because 2 damage isn't enough to do damage. Like, 2 hits isn't enough to do damage because his DR is 3.
Yeah.
They're considered to be floating dice. Now, anytime you're mitigating the amount of damage that you're doing, like the damage markers are reducing damage or shields are reducing damage, you always take away from the floating pool first and from mm-hmm. the furthest model down in priority. So that front tank is still getting rocked. Like, doesn't matter what he does, that tank is taking the brunt because it's got 3 tanks literally trying to shoot through it to get to the tank behind it. And you handle that in such a way, very simply. You say, okay, I'm going to shoot at that squad. Target priority is that guy, that guy, that guy. All right. So then all the damage is assigned to that guy first. So like I said, if I got 8 hits, I'll put 3 dice there and then another 3 dice there to show that I've hit his DR twice. And then once we've done all of our resolving, if a ship's destroyed, you take it off. If there's a damage marker to put down, you put it down. That's it. And then you roll your disorder check. After any damage is dealt immediately, you place disorder tokens and then you go. Mm-hmm. That's it. Like that, I've basically read all of the rules to you at that point. That it's very, very simple. What's interesting is that you still can't assign damage to a ship that you can't see, right?
Yep.
So even if you're shooting at a squad, if nobody can see that ship, it's just not in the priority. So that floating pool will not then be assigned to that extra ship. And then the other fun thing to note is that anytime you're shooting a ship in the sides, its DR is reduced by 1 at all levels. If you shoot it in the rear, its DR is reduced by 2 at all levels. So again, think like 40K, where you've got front armor, side armor, rear armor. It's exactly that, except it's standardized across the board for all vehicles.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I was drinking beer, so I couldn't add more than that. I was like, mouthful.
And that's it. This book is 116 pages, essentially, of rules. Like, it is really, really, really short.
Well, and even then, the first 60 of them are basically, hey, everybody, these are the races and fires.
It's actually 130 pages. I cut 15 out.
Right. But yeah, it's just like there's a tiny bit of fluff at the beginning, and then everything else is just like list composition before, you know, fucking deployment and deploying scenery and this and that. The rules set itself is great. As I said at the top of the show, I feel like this is them taking the best parts of their existing games and streamlining the rest in the interests of speed and fun.
You ever gone streamlining? It's fucking crazy.
Right? You just get a whole lot of limes.
Oh, my God. You stick them up your ass. It's crazy. Oh, I saw some shit, Nathan. I saw some shit.
Was that when you were playing bass?
Oh, my God. So basically, the other thing to talk about with this game is the force organization, the list building. If you guys read the blog post that Spartan had up on their site, you already have a pretty good idea of exactly how this works. They explain it very simply in the book in terms of how you use allies and natural allies and things of that nature, which is a lot of fun. Essentially, what you have is a core helix. The core helix, we assume, because we don't actually have any of these books at this point.
Yep.
The core helix, according to the list that we've been given as examples, essentially says, right, here's the mandatory bits of your core helix. And
yep.
What we have in the starter kit is literally like half a core helix. So, like, the mandatory parts of your core helix, like, all are built into that. You then have the option to take a flyer helix, a recon helix, a heavy helix, a, what is it, artillery helix? Is that the one I'm thinking of? I'm actually going to flip to the book because I think I'm missing one.
That's what I was going to say. So you have Leviathan, you have heavy armor, you have...
Leviathan was the other one, yeah.
Allied support, you have recon.
Here we go. Air, field support, Leviathan, recon, assault, and heavy.
Yeah.
And essentially those six attached helixes, you can take one of each of them, and there you go, you're happy. That is, you would essentially be at your max for what you are allowed to take.
In a single battle group.
In a single battle group. And we'll talk a little bit about battle groups as well as we kind of build, we go on to like building a force thing. But let's say I want to take two aerial helixes. How does that affect me, Nathan?
If you take two aerial helixes, basically what you're going to do is you're going to look at the chart that they have here. You're going to look what is exactly opposite the air, which in this case is recon. And by taking two air, you're basically saying that your force cannot contain a single recon helix. And that's how it works. It's basically just like you can have at most two helixes. So if I'm playing my Terran, I got my core, I decide I want two Leviathans, it means I cannot have a single heavy armor helix. Period. There's just nothing I can do about it. The way they handle allies is very interesting.
Oh, wait, hold on. Before we get
what do you want to talk about?
The core helix idea is not a single group for a single game. You are not specifically restricted to playing a game with one core helix, right?
Yes.
Depending on the size of the game, they've basically said, we recommend that if you're playing this size of game, you play with one core helix. But they say at essentially larger games, you could decide to play a game where you're like, right, so we're playing 4,000 points, two core helixes available to you. So you could play all 4,000 points in one helix if you wanted to, or you could split that into two 2,000 point or, you know, a 1,000 point.
Well, 3,000 point. But again, it doesn't say how many points have to go into each helix, but basically similar to a game of Dystopian Wars, right? So in a game of Dystopian Wars, we're going to say, okay, let's play a 1,200 point game with a naval core. And that determines the things that I have to do, right? So it means that I have to have one large, one medium, one small, all from my naval core. And then after that, as long as I'm not breaking their rules on percentages, go to fucking town. Take whatever you want. Is it an air unit? Is it whatever? That's the kind of way it works. Whereas, you know, if you're saying, okay, let's play a 5,000 point game using two battle groups, it means that I have to take a minimum of two core helixes. But I can fuck around with them however I want. So if I want a 4,000-point helix over here and a 1,000-point helix, it doesn't actually matter because – or battle groups, not helixes. But like it doesn't matter how I'm splitting my points because there's a subsequent rule about activations where when you choose your first squad to activate – you have to activate all remaining squads of that helix before you can choose a different helix to do. Mm-hmm. So there are advantages and disadvantages to heavy loading one particular helix or not, etc., etc. So I think that that's interesting. But the other thing that is interesting is when you talk about allies, they basically give you three ways to treat allies. The first and easiest is natural allies are treated like your army for all purposes. So,
with the exception of whatever you take for natural allies still cannot be larger than your core helix size.
Yes, that is the one exception. So you can't spend more points on Works Raptor than you spend on Directorate. That's it. So whatever your core helix is composed of, you just have to make sure you have more points of that. Otherwise, plug and play as much as you want, no problems. Mm-hmm. The other thing that they say with allies that you can do, especially if you're playing a large game with multiple battle groups, is just take one battle group of Army X, one battle group of Army Y, provided they belong to either the Alliance of Kurok or the Xenian League. Okay, so that's the only exception to allies. Just like Firestorm Armada, you cannot mix cross-faction in that way. It's like World of Warcraft up in this bitch. You got Horde, you got Alliance, deal with it. So, you know, with Lang, he plays Directorate. He could have one battle group that's Directorate using as many of his points as he wants, and one battle group that's, let's say, Rolthosa because the spiders are fucking cool. Mm-hmm. And you go to town that way. You know, finally, there's a third way to use allies, and that is if you're only playing a single battle group and you're taking an ally that is not a natural ally as something. So a good example of this, because when we look through the rule book, we can see that there are Terran Leviathans, there are Dendrenzi Leviathans. The good example of this is, let's say Lang wanted to take a Leviathan, the Dendrenzi Leviathan, with his Directorate. When he takes that, it immediately locks out any further Leviathan choices, mm-hmm. and it locks out the heavy that's across the way. So that's the one thing to keep in mind is normally I can choose to take two of one side or one of each side. If I take a non-natural ally, it locks me down. I can have one Leviathan, nothing else along that straight line path. And I like it. I think that it's super simple. It's super elegant. You're not having to worry about, you know, 40K, where it's just like, hey, I've got this one HQ, and I've got the one troops, and I've got all these things, where it's just like, no, you can feel free to take a field support of Cerulean's in your Aquan force, because, hey, everyone's aligned to Kurok, they're loving life, but by doing that, you get no more field support, and you cannot take an Assault Helix, so choose wisely.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the choices in army list composition. I mean, really, what has been my only complaint with 7th edition is the fact that there are no choices to make. It's like, pick a points limit and take whatever the fuck you want, who cares?
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem. I love a system that is challenging me and is giving me hard choices to make. So if I want to play one army only, or even with natural allies, great. I have all of the tactical flexibility that that involves. Do I want to mix and match within my faction? Yeah, go for it, but keep in mind that there are consequences.
Right. Well, and I think what's interesting about this is really one of the first times, especially from Spartan, that we've seen a kind of self-balancing force organization chart, in the sense that it's not just, here are your caps, maxes, and minimums. There's nothing in here that is similar to what we've seen in Firestorm Armada, in the sense that they say, like, oh yeah, well, you have to take a minimum of one frigate group and then you can take up to three. It's saying that, like, you can't take any more than two of anything, but taking two of that locks out other options. Like, the most you can ever get in a battle group is a core helix and six attached helixes. That's it. You'll never be able to put more than that on the table. However, how you access and use those is essentially locking out other sections of those attack, like your options. So you can make the fully balanced one with a core helix and one of each helix. And if that works for you, great. But if you really love the heavy armor helix out of the Cerulean's and you take those, then you have to look at that and go, like, right, well, I can't take Leviathans now. I'm completely locked out from that option in my list. So you kind of look at it and you go, well, all right, we all play miniature games, and in miniature games, typically one squad of one thing is not ever really enough for us. It's always like, well, no, if I like it, I want two or three squads, right? So you, you it, it becomes a little bit more of a you know,
a balancing
it,
act.
It is. It is. It's hard to say without actually looking at the books, because I don't know what's going to be involved in these helixes. Where, like, if I say I do take a heavy armor helix, I can still take three squads in it or some shit.
Yeah.
You know, so it is really hard to look at this and say, hey, here's how this would actually work, without actually having seen the books yet, the actual army.
Well, and that's exactly it is. We don't know if core helixes are going to have minimums where it's just like two infantry squads and one.
No, we do. We've seen, if you turn to page 59, they give you the example of the force org for building an Aquan force, and they've got a 4,000 point Aquan force here. And when you look at the core helix, and each of the various attached helixes that they have, like, it shows you anything marked with an asterisk is a requisite for the respective helix and must be taken before other elements can be taken. But again, I don't know how much of those other elements can be taken. Because in the core helix for the Aquans, all you need is one heavy tank squadron.
Yeah.
No, one heavy, one medium, and one light. You don't even have to take the infantry.
I don't even see an asterisk beside a medium. Oh, there it is. Yeah, right below it.
At the end of the sentence.
Yeah, but see, when you're reading the heavy and the light, it's on the top line.
Yeah, exactly.
Not sandwiched between the brackets on
Editing. So yeah, exactly. It's one of those things where... I love the idea of it, but until I see how big can I make these helixes, like, can I really max out a helix to the point where I'll walk into a game with a maxed out core helix and a maxed out, you know, heavy helix and be like, how you play the game. That's how you win the game.
A maxed out core helix and then, like, all of these other helixes that are one squad, so you can just have those free activations before you have to devote yourself into your core helix.
Right.
Because even when you look at the Aquan Heavy Helix, it has one Sedna Heavy Tank Squadron as the only compulsory.
Right.
You know, whereas you look at the Turquoise, and it's just like, well, the Heavy Gunship, the Heavy Infantry, and a Temporal Portal are all requisites. So like I said, it's just like, there is a lot of stuff, especially with that requirement of you pick a squad, you activate the rest of his helix before you can move to a different helix. So it's just like, yeah, you might want to just go whole hog on one helix, throwing as many activations and as many points as you possibly can into there, so that way your Leviathan goes last, or, you know, however you want to play it. So it's just like, again, there's that extra layer of strategy that is directly related to your tabletop experience based on how you're building your army. And again, like, you know, as much as we complain, we start off the show by complaining about the cheapness of the fucking components that you're getting in the starter set, and even that commander set they're selling for release in December 6th, which is literally all of the shitty components of the starter set pulled out and sold separately. I think the game is great so far. I mean, our one game was super fun. I ended up winning because I went whole ham on objectives, scoring my points there. You were playing the long game with objectives, I think, where you were going to try to soften me up a bit and then hammer into objectives, whereas I just shot out for them.
Right. Well, I wanted the TV values from, like, killing your squads, but then you remember how those first two turns went.
Oh, my God. So our first turn, all of your attacks, including your cyber warfare, did nothing. And all of my attacks did nothing. And in the second turn, all of your attacks did nothing. And then I think I did 1 point of damage on one cyber warfare vehicle. That's correct. I was like, woo, this has been the first two turns, ladies and gentlemen.
That is correct.
Nothing has happened.
Right, exactly. Like...
It was just three, our dice turned on and we started killing shit. But
yeah, we started ripping stuff up at that point. But man, it really, the game grabs you really fast. And part of it is the models. They look great, even on, like, a Tron Tupperware table.
I was not even upset that we were doing that. I mean, no. Obviously nothing is painted because we'd literally just pulled it out of the bubble wrap and went at it. But it's just like, yeah, I didn't even mind because the game itself was so fun. And there was so much depth there. Because again, like, I mean, you were playing your directorate exactly how you had to. I was playing my Aquans where I was trying to cut angles and shoot around corners and hide from you because I didn't want you to fuck me up. Like, you have more guns than I do.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just trying to hide from you as much as I could and rely on the objectives. One other thing we didn't talk about is tack cards. I kind of want to bring it to an end on tack cards because I think that the mechanics they have are brilliant. So tack cards are played exactly like all of the other games that have them. You know, at the beginning of the turn, you choose whether or not you're going to play one. Now, there is a points cost on the bottom, and what I love about it is if I choose to play a tack card, I immediately increase my 0 hour tracker by the cost on that card, which I didn't see a 3-point card. I think there were only 1 and 2-point cards.
Mm-hmm.
I might be mistaken. There could have been a 3-point, but basically, to play a tack card and get that benefit, you are saying, I am going to be further from winning the game.
Right.
Right out of the gates. And I like that so much better than the Firestorm system, because when you play a tack card in Firestorm, it's free. It is free, and there's only a cost if I want to get that card back. Now, there is also a card to retrieve, or a cost to retrieve tack cards in Planetfall, and it's fucking brutal because it is 3 times the value of the card you played. So basically, you have to increase your 0 hour tracker by 3 to pick up a 1-point card, which brings the total cost to 4 because it cost you 1 to play it, 3 to retrieve it, and then 1 to play it again. So you're talking 4 to 5 points further away from winning. And 5 points is literally wiping out an entire tank squadron.
Yeah.
So you're saying if I'm going to play this card, retrieve it, and play it again, I better wipe out this medium squadron of yours just to be even on the process.
Yeah, I think the big thing with tacks in this game is tacks are an aspect of snowballing the game for you. If you're really winning and the game is a large size game with a fairly high 0 hour counter to start with, you may be looking at playing tack cards because a point, 2 points, not that big of a deal. But if you really have the game going your way and you are in a position to do a lot of damage, what's nice about the tack cards is they tend to have much higher, broader sweeping types of effects. And what I mean by that is they'll say this tack card affects this entire helix. Everybody gets this bonus.
Yes.
And, because you're able to do that, if you are in a position to say, you know what, I'll give them, you know, 4 points or 5 points to do this 2 turns in a row because I'm just crushing this guy. I know that even if I do pay 5 points, you know, another 4 points to take it back and play it again after the initial play.
Yep.
I know I'm going to get 4 points off of killing a tank squad on this because I'm just going to be trucking this guy. So, like I said, the way I looked at the tack cards, especially after playing it in the first game, is that they really are about snowballing. They're about late game. They're about pushing to try to get to that 0 hour quickly as possible, as opposed to being conservative. Well, yes, the Hail Mary, but...
The Hail Mary and playing it, because basically what happened in our game...
They don't help you in a Hail Mary, though, because...
See, but I think they can, because if I'm looking at it, so for example... When we played, you played your Cyber Warfare tack turn one, so hey, you were 1 point higher. Who cares? I was looking at it where I was just like, okay, if I play no tacks, I will win this turn unless you can somehow push me off a secondary objective, right? But if I play a tack, but not playing that tack, like I was looking at it where I'm like, I think I'll lose my medium tank squads because you're just going to fuck them up. Like, that was the squad that you'd picked. You were shooting it. You were focus firing it the way you should have been. And I was just looking at it where I'm like, you know, shit, I'm down to 2 guys. All you really need to do is shoot them with 2 different squads, possibly put on a couple of disorder tokens, and I'm fucked. Mm-hmm. And then it would have been a draw. Or actually, it would have been a minor loss for me because you would have earned more TV in that turn. You'd have still gotten to 0. I would have gotten to 0. So I was looking at it, I'm like, I got to take the risk, and I had to play that tack card, which pushed me out of the winning that turn phase. And I was like, now I have to destroy something. So, I mean, what I like about it is when you're talking about that Hail Mary is when you're getting close, like on that turn when you looked at it and I was going to win, if you had one, and I didn't know what tax you took, but it's just like one that's like a helix wide thing, that's the turn you play it, where you're like,
right,
I'm doing the Hail Mary because if I don't do this, I'm going to lose, unless my dice just show up for some reason. So you're just like, bam, I'm going to pay the point or the 2 points or the 3 points possibly. But it's just like, you're not going to retrieve it. I think that's the big thing is what I love about the system is they're like, you can retrieve it, but holy shit, what a big deal. Unless, like you said, you're playing a big game. You're playing 6,000 points. Our 0 hour starts at 60. What the fuck do I care about 3 points?
Right. One of the other interesting things, now that you brought it up, it sparked it in my brain. Activations in this game work similar to other Spartan games. You take turns. You roll your tactics check at the beginning of the turn to see who gets to go first.
Oh, yeah.
But what's very interesting about this is that, let's say I have a core helix, a kill helix. You pass out?
No, I just...
You knocked the cord out of your mic because now...
No, we're good now. Hey, I just spilled beer. I spilled beer because I'm drunk and clumsy. I was like, I'm going to go drink some beer. And then I just knocked the glass with my club hand.
And then you power bombed it?
Yes. Because fuck that beer, man.
The only way to drink beer is an elbow from the top rope. Am I right, ladies?
I think I'm going to need a new keyboard. Between spitting beer last episode and now spilling some on it, like, this has just been a bad month for me and my keyboard.
There you go. Back on track. The way that it works is that you still activate squad by squad. So, like, I'll activate a squad, Nathan activates a squad, and so on and so forth. However, if I have my core helix, I've got an aerial helix, and I've got a heavy helix.
Oh, I've already talked about this. I thought you were going to talk logistics.
No, not yet. Because what we didn't talk about is how when you activate a unit, like a squad from a helix, you have to continue to activate squads from that helix until it is completely done before you can begin activating squads from
other helixes. All right, so the weekly listener poll for this week is, has Nathan already mentioned this fact?
I don't remember. Anyways, I found it interesting. So why don't you talk about logistics points then?
I was going to say, that stir-fry beer must be strong.
Both of these are gross.
Oh, really?
Oh, my God.
All right. No,
the stir-fry beer is just like, it's beer and ginger. Two great.
Oh my god! No, it is ginger with a hint of beer, and that is the problem with it. Because that ginger beer that you gave us the last time, you're just like, yeah, this is good ginger beer because it's sweet, it's gingery, it's alcoholic, it's perfect. Right. That is just like straight ginger. That starts as beer, and then that's all you taste.
Yeah, and then the Swingspan Amber Ale is just so goddamn bitter.
Oh,
it is the skunkiest beer I've had in a long time.
Well, it's no wonder that it was left at your house. Thank you. Hey, listen, I didn't do it. I brought all my beer home because I only bought growlers. Okay, so logistics points. Logistics points is a very interesting mechanic, as far as I'm concerned, because basically what it does is it rewards armies with good supply chains. And the example that I made was like, you know, if we're talking 40K, who is going to be better at moving people and being in the right position, world eaters or ultramarines? Because basically the way the mechanic works is when you are building your list, you can choose to purchase a number of logistics points. Now, the cost of these points and
how... I'll just hear you like fumbling around and cleaning.
I am talking and trying to clean beer, and that is literally all I'm doing. But basically, your fleet list, and I don't even care, I'm not even stopping. Like, you pointed it out, I don't care because I have to get the beer out from under the monitor or it's gonna... Yeah, anyway. At least I didn't get it in the monitor, just on its stand. So your fleet list will include how many logistics points you can purchase, as well as how much they cost, and finally how many you can bid on a single bid phase. Because the way it works is when you roll an initiative, it's your typical Spartan mechanic of 2d6 plus fleet tactics. And if I lose that roll, I can choose to initiate a fleet logistics bid. And that is where, in secret, both players will bid a number of fleet tactics points that they have purchased up to the max that their fleet list says, and add those to their
roll
total. So it is a way for the player who went second and really fucking wants to go first or needs to go first.
And it had to have been a close roll.
Well, yeah, because I was going to say, the one time I was going to do it, I rolled a 4 and you rolled a 12. And I was like, well, my 2 fleet tactics points are certainly not bridging this gap. But yeah, that's exactly it. It's like, if there's ever one where you lose it by 1 point, bam, start a bid.
Yeah.
Because holy shit. I think that's such an interesting mechanic, because if you didn't buy fleet logistics points, I can take it from you. But because the bidding is done in secret, where basically you both pick a D6, you secretly mark down how many you're going to bid, and then you reveal at the same time and figure out who actually has initiative. What I thought was interesting is, like, my first thought was, early game, you're just like, I'm going to initiate a bid. You bid 0, because who fucking cares, in the hopes that he bids and burns his, so that late game you can just take it. You know, like, but I'm just like, again, like, I really like that extra layer where it's just like, I could bid 0, I could just bid 1, I could try to get you, because if you think you need to go first, you could just bid your max and bid your way out of logistics points. So I'm just like, I love the fact that there is an additional mechanic. You know, I don't know what it cost for the director, because I didn't bother looking, but like, for Aquins, it was just like 25 points per logistic point. And I could bid maximum 4. Again, I thought it was great. I just thought it was such a nice touch. Because how many times when you've played Firestorm have you just been like... And especially you as director, where you only get the +1. Where it's just like, oh my god, I need to go first. I need first activation because I need to activate this for reason X. You know, because like, I have played enough to know that those situations happen. And when they do, it just... You know, you feel like your whole game comes down to that one dice roll, but here is a mechanic that allows for you, again, at that list building phase where it's just like you can choose to spend 100 points on logistics points basically to get that initiative the turn you need it, or you can buy 100 points worth of stuff.
Yeah, and there's still attack.
More important.
And there's still attack card that also allows you to get a bonus to that tactics roll as well for initiative. So, I mean, like, there are a lot of things that they give you to mitigate the kind of shittiness of that 2d6 roll every turn. But it's a nice addition to the game. I don't necessarily love it, but I would have to play with it a lot more to really see how much is that affecting the game. Almost explicitly because of the fact that the larger you're playing the game, that extra 100 points or two is not really going to be... making a big difference, and because squads tend to cost a fair amount in this game, like those 3 tanks is like 360 points or some such.
Well, I mean, like, even in our game, because yours came to 1215 and mine came to 1200 when I removed two items, we just decided to say 1250 points. You bought 1 logistics point, I bought 2. You won every initiative so soundly that I never even had a chance to use it.
That's right.
But I guess the question that I have for you is, if you were going into a tournament where it's just like fixed list, you had to choose then and there, would you not make it a priority to say, in a 4-game tournament, I need to make sure that I have at least 4 logistics points, so when the shit hits the fan and I fucking need this initiative roll, I can just bid it if I lose it? Because I think I would. Like, it's like when you do set list Firestorm Armada, where it's just like all of your tac cards have to be chosen in advance. You take the reserves card knowing that there's going to be a time you might need it.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends, because, like, for instance, I'm looking for this. Hold on a second. Oh, fuck, even a light tank squad is really expensive. Yeah, I think considering the cost of the squads, it's very likely that you are going to run into a scenario where you've got close to 100 points left over. So I think in those situations, you're going to be close to that max anyway. So I think the game is kind of nudging you in that direction, similar to how you remember back in like first edition Firestorm Armada, when you had the opportunity to just buy loose wings of fighters and bombers that would just essentially show up on the table edge to kind of make up those points up to the limit. I feel like that's what this is kind of in there for. But yeah, I do agree in the sense that if I was going into a tournament, I would probably buy my max and then build the rest of my force around it, considering that even at my max, if it was 25 points, it's still less than the cost of recon ships, right? Like recon buggies. So
yeah.
I'm not even really looking at this going like, man, I'm giving up a whole squad for this, you know? So it's almost like you're dumb not to do that. Like, you're kind of stupid to take, like, a half squad of infantry as opposed to taking these, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, like, for me, when I looked at it, I was just like, listen, in our game, it's probably not going to do anything. And because you monstrously beat me on initiative. Because I think there was one initiative we tied, and then you rolled, like, 8 points higher than me. I'm like, Well, your gold dice have decided that initiative shall be yours this day. But then they'd fuck up shooting, so it's not like your dice were super hot. It was just like initiative were always so big that it didn't make a difference. But when I read this rule, my first thought was, going into a tournament, I will always have enough to win that key turn. Or at least what I perceive to be the key turn. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to make sure that, you know, when the shit hits the fan and I fucking need it, it's there for me. And that's what I like, because again, we know it's a dice game. Like, you know, and especially those fleet tactics plus one players, like you with Directorate, you know, because I'm just like, yeah, Dendrenzi players can go to hell with their plus three. But it's just like, I play a lot of plus two fleets. So for me, it's one way or the other. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I win it, sometimes I lose it. It's great. But it's just like, there are turns where I'm like, dear God, I need this. If I don't get that first activation, the fucking dreadnought is dead. So, like, I need to get it. I need to move it behind the planet. I need to initiate the fold space drive. Like, I need the activation. Mm-hmm. Well, so, I love the fact that there's that redundancy where it's just like pay points and you can almost guarantee it for a turn.
Well, what's nice about it as well is once logistics points are spent, they are gone, as you said earlier. So, as you start getting to the late turns when that initiative is really, really going to make or break you, there is always an opportunity that you will run into knowing that your opponent has spent all of his logistics points. So you're almost looking at it going like, I'm rolling like a plus five, plus six right now. Because even if I lose, I know I have this many tactics points that he cannot compete against.
Yes.
And that is going to help me get that turn for at least that one turn, right? So yeah, yep. It is a really interesting thing. All right, so that is Planetfall. As we've seen so far, very positive review from both of us. The game is super interesting. I love the way that it works. I love the way that the disorder works and the shooting works and the movement works, because it's very, very fast. It's very quick. We both agree that we got to get a game going at a much larger scale, because it seems like the type of game that on a 6x4 board with a bunch of scenery and a shit ton of little tanks running around would just be a ton of fun. So,
well, and even then, like, my heavy tank at, like, I think 240 points has 20 dice at long range, two of them which would cost a fuckload of points, get 40 dice? Oh, shit. Like, that's the point where it's just like, yeah, that squadron of heavies is going to open up on a squadron of mediums, and it's going to absolutely fucking maul it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, nothing is super tough in the game. Like not like Firestorm, where things just hang around and hang around and hang around.
Okay, yeah, I agree with that there. I mean, we haven't seen the super big stuff yet, but I mean, even with those 20 dice, right? Like, say you roll 20 dice and you get 16 hits. That's a tank, one tank. That's one Directorate tank dies. And that's on, like, when you did that big-ass roll, you fluffed it and you got, what did you get, like 12? So it was like, yeah, you did a point of damage. You know, like, it's one of those things where, like I said, the firepower in the game is dramatically lower than how tough the vehicles are, which is why when you look at things like Disorder, you know, if you have the option in the lists to, say, upgrade your shit all to Elite, or you're playing a list where you want to keep everything cheap and everything's coming out like Militia, where they're rolling less dice, but maybe you're keeping them closer to the command elements, like, if that's a possibility, well, that opens up a whole bunch of new doors as well, which is a super cool aspect of the game that could kind of either, you know, make it or break it. But again, we still just don't know right now. We don't know what options are. The fact that there's no hardpoint upgrade options, as we've seen so far, is kind of a weird bit to the game, considering what we've seen in the direction. But, you know, from the perspective of the game being fast and fun, as opposed to Firestorm Armada or Dystopian, where you're chugging through all these rules,
yeah,
I get it. So I'm not complaining about it. All right. Absolutely. So that brings us to the weekly listener poll question for this week. The question we have for you guys in this particular case is, do you feel that streamlined, fast and fun rules trump more complicated, let's say like in-depth rules, right? So like if we were to compare this to Firestorm Armada, where the reason why we love that game is, boy, that game, the tactical brilliance of it is the fact that you constantly have to be monitoring all this shit that's happening, right? And like that is part of the fun of the game. Like, yes, it's a little bit weighty and it slows you down, but some people love that. Like, I love it. I can't get enough of that shit.
Oh, yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. As much as I have been comparing it negatively to Firestorm Armada,
right.
I still love Firestorm because, like, it's always the difference, like, when you're at a restaurant, it's the difference between, like, a nice, easy, like, appetizer and, like, a big old fucking T-bone steak. And, sometimes you're just in the mood for that fucking T-bone where it's just like, I want something meaty. I want something that has so much involved to it that I'm going to feel full after a game or two, right? You know, like that. And Firestorm is still scratching that itch. Like, I don't see Planetfall replacing it because they are very different games.
But yeah, there we go. You can find that at jadedgamercast.com. But that has been Jaded Gamercast for this week. My name is Lang.
I'm Nathan.
Have a good one.
Cheers.